commanded to go in. He commanded Noah and his family to get in the ark. And you don't get out until he tells you to get out. And so we're going to see that in chapter 8. He told them when to go in and when to come out. Now, does that matter? It does matter. Remember, Solomon was going to be king, and he's praying. And God let Solomon know. He said, whatever you ask me, I'll give it to you. You know what he asked for? He said, Lord, I want you to teach me how to go in and how to come out. Very important request, because we think we know, but we don't know anything. He teaches us what we should know. He trains us on what we should know. The only thing we know, there's a way that seems right to man, but the end of it is death. The end result is death. It seems right. You don't want to go on what seems to be good, what seems to be the right thing. You don't want to do that. You want to know that you've looked at everything and you've been commanded to go in. And so that's what we learned last night. Noah was commanded to enter the ark, and he was commanded to exit the ark. He didn't just exit the ark because he felt like it. There's a certain timing that had to take place. Certain things had to be put in position in order for Noah to leave. What if he'd, you know, he was 16,000 feet on the mountains of Ararat. Well, that's high elevation. Guess what still lays beneath? Still time that you got to wait for all the water to recede. So you look out the ark and the ground's dry where it sits, but it's not dry where you need to go. And so you have to wait till it completely gets there. So these are the things that we're going to look at this morning. So we're going to finish up 7 and go right into 8. So Matthew, I want you to go to Genesis 7, and I'll read verse 17 through all the way to chapter 8. In Genesis 7, verse 17, the flood was on the earth 40 days, and the waters increased and lifted up the ark, and it rose high above the earth. And the waters were mighty and greatly increased on the earth, and the ark moved about on the surface of the water. So we learned something about moving about on the surface of the water is that word halak, which has to do with how one walks or how one conducts their life. It's the manner of life. And so if we're going to walk after Yeshua, we have to be in Yeshua. To be in Yeshua is to take on that identity. Not you, but his identity. We take on his identity, and he now represents me. So if you hire somebody to represent you in a court of law, you don't go in there and tell your lawyer to sit down and shut up, and you take the case over. But in many facets, I believe, as we say that we're in Yeshua and we hired him, he's been now representing us. We want to be the speaker, and our one who represents us sits on the sideline. If you're in Messiah and he represents you, let him do the speaking. If he's doing the speaking, the only thing we got to do is do the hearing. We have to listen to what he says. So he's going to represent us well. In his words that he speaks, he definitely reflects in the renewed writings what words he's speaking, where he's getting his information. He says he's getting it from Scripture. And the Scripture that he had at that point was the Torah. That's all he had. We don't have a renewed writings compiled for quite some time after he was ascended back on high. We don't have a compiled renewed writings. And so he had the Scripture, and that's where he delivered his messages from, based on that Scripture. So if you want to know what text he was pulling from, that's what he was pulling from. Everything left of Matthew, he pulled a text from that. That's the thing that he used to deliver the message that anything outside of that, he would have been doing something that God never authorized. And we know he didn't do that. He only spoke the things that God spoke to him to speak. That's it. And so the reason I believe it's important for us to understand the text that Yeshua used is we're very unlearned in that text. And so we're trying to make sense of the renewed text, but we don't know what the old letter said to us, so we can then understand it. How many see that we learned some things last night by taking the old text, which is what this word talking about halak, and then went back to the renewed writings and pulled out several areas where Yeshua walked on the water. Why did he walk on the water? How did he walk on the water? Because the water, he had authority over the seas. And what naturally should have happened couldn't happen because he was not going to be overcome by his surroundings. He controlled that by simply staying in Yeshua. Yeshua stayed in the Father, and the Father was in him. And so he had that ability because he was in the Father and the Father was in him. And so we see throughout, from the very beginning of creation, we never see that the waters overwhelmed the Creator at any time. But the Creator dictated where water went. How many of you remember we were reading that? He dictates where water goes. Matter of fact, he created a firmament, something hard called a rakia, to separate waters from waters. What kind of power is that? At no time did Jehovah was subject to waters overtaken. He controlled it in the entirety of it. He separated waters from waters. And then it said the spirit of Jehovah hovered over the face of the water. The word, he brooded there. There he is. He's about to do, he causes the ripple on the seas. And so he controls the seas. The seas don't control him. But we know if we're going around and we walk off the dock and take a step on the water, what happens? The sea controls us. We immediately sink. Immediately. It overwhelms us. But in Messiah, there's something that happens that is powerful. And we see it in the life of Kepha and Peter. What happened? He said, if it's you, bid me come. And he got out of the boat. That's the boat of security. He got out of the boat of security. And once he did that, you have to put full faith in Messiah. If not, you're going to sink. Now Kepha's walking on the water. Did not the text say Kepha's walking on the water? Yeshua's on the water and Kepha, a regular guy just like us, he's walking on the water. How is that possible? Because he locked eyes with Yeshua. And that's all he saw. The moment he looked and saw the storm was severe, he sank immediately. That ought to tell us something. We have to lock eyes with him and stay locked. And the only time we see trouble, anytime in the family, anytime we see trouble in the church, anytime we see trouble at any level, is when our eyes turn off of his. When we quit locking, every time. In your personal walk, the only time you see trouble is when that happens. The moment you turn away from locking eyes with him, you're going to be met with trouble. Because what surrounds you is the deluge that's taken every human and every beast. It took them. The only one safe was in the ark. Only the eight in the ark and the animals in the ark was safe. That's it. If they'd have got out the ark, they wouldn't have been safe. You got to be inside. And so the same thing with us. We have to be in Messiah. If we're not in Messiah, we're not safe. And what distracts you from getting, from being in Messiah is when we turn and we look to see what's happening around us. And when we do that every time, not sometimes, every time, you're going to be met with a deluge of problems. And you're going to think, my, where's all this coming from? The moment you take your eyes off of him, you start looking at the circumstance, the situation, just like Kepha. He immediately sank. And what did Yeshua did? He reached out and grabbed him. And when he grabbed him, he brought him to the boat, and immediately the storm ceased. Why did this storm cease? Because Yeshua was in control of all of it. He didn't have a doubt one. When he saw him out there from the mountain, he's praying. He sees them out there, and they're rowing. They're toiling and rowing and going nowhere, meaning they have come to the limit. They have exhausted themselves by their own strength. They were not going to make it to the other side. They weren't going to make it. So he came walking on the water to assist them, to show them something that we're going to be on the other side, but you got to get your faith increased. You got to start believing. They were starting. Now we're not, the panic set in. There's no way we're going to make it. Can you hear the conversation on that boat? We're in trouble. It's all over. We're never going to make it. We're not going to make it. They couldn't look to the hinder part of the ship because there was no Yeshua there. This was a different story, different time. But where was he? He was on the mountain and he was praying. But all of a sudden he shows up walking on the water, and that conversation then took a shift. And that conversation shifted because when they saw this was not natural. This was an unnatural event that they seen, and they thought it was a phantom or a ghost. And then Yeshua speaks to them and lets them know it's him. Take courage, he said. Be of good courage. Don't be afraid. Because he's seen the fear setting in. And he sees the fear when it sets in us. He sees when we get afraid. He sees when we get anxious. He sees when we start to be overtaken by the waves of life and the swells of circumstance come and overtop our head. He sees that. Let me tell you, the atmosphere changes when a wave comes completely in the boat and soaks everybody. It changes. And if you've been in those situations, as long as you're riding them high and everything's going good, all of a sudden, one comes and it changes the situation. The attitude changes. You know, as long as you're doing that, I've been on boats where I have people with me, and man, we just taking them side. I mean, it's beautiful. And you're watching them break, because boy, and you're watching them. And you make it to the channel, and the customers, man, that was awesome. Then I've been in them where you're going like that, and all of a sudden one gets you, and everybody's soaking wet. And you can see them, they grab the fiberglass a little harder, and they're holding on. They get over and say, we don't want to do that again. Because it changes our perception and how we feel. And so what happens is God is showing us through the life of Noah, if he wouldn't have gotten in the ark and gotten security and safety, he would have been met with the same fate as everybody else. And so what makes us think that we won't be met with the same fate unless we get our mind made up that we're going to serve him and serve him only and look at him and him only? What makes us think it's going to be any different? It's not. And so we'll see that as we continue reading. The waters were exceedingly mighty on the earth, and all the high mountains under the heavens were covered. The waters became mighty. 15 cubits above the mountains were covered, and all flesh died, creeping creatures on the earth, birds and cattle and beasts and every swarming creature that swarmed on the earth, and all mankind and all in whose nostril was the breath of the spirit of life, all that was on dry land died. So he wiped off all that stands, which were on the face of the ground, both man and beast, creeping creatures and birds of the heaven, and they were wiped off from the earth, and only Noah was left, and those with him in the ark, and the waters were mighty on the earth 150 days. Now, what I want you to understand, these waters were mighty on the earth 150 days, was not the entire length of time that they were in the ark. The entire length of time they were in the ark is explained to us in the 8th chapter. There was a lot of time transpired. So I want you to understand this event was not an event that lasted 40 days. It rained 40 days and 40 nights. That's people's conception of it. It rained 40 days and 40 nights, and the water covered the earth, and they got out the boat after 40 days. And that's what people get. They read the story real fast. That's what they get out of it. Because if you ask people questions about, no, yeah, it was 40 days and 40 nights. And that's their limit. That's the limit of their capacity of understanding it. But we see that in the latter part of the seventh chapter, he says that the waters were mighty on the earth 150 days. Mighty, meaning it was a tumult. It was a deluge. It was rocking and reeling for a long time. The boat had to withstand some things. Remember in Kepha's situation what they had to do? They had to undergird the vessel, meaning they strapped ropes every so many feet and tied them on the gunwales, tight as they can get, so they can keep the boards from coming apart, because they were in it themselves for a while. And for 14 days, they were in this battle. And so I want you to remember that that's significant for us, because 14 is very important in that story of Kepha, because it's going to be mentioned again in the 8th chapter of Genesis. We're going to see it mentioned, so we're going to make some connections. How many thank God that he connects his word and plainly speaks to us? So let's look at the 8th chapter. And Elohim remembered Noah. He remembered him. And just like he remembers you, when you're in it and you don't know what to do, you know what he does? He remembers you. He remembers you. He's not forgotten you. He remembered Noah. He said, he didn't go, oh, I forgot. Noah's in the ark, 150 days in this deluge. I got to remember him. That's not how it happened. He had made sure that he knew exactly who was in the ark the entire time. He knew every wave that hit that boat. He knew every raindrop that comes from the top. He knew everything that was happening the entire time, because God remembers Noah. He remembers you. When you think you've been forgotten, just remember, God never forgets. He remembers you. He knows what you're going through. He knows what's happening in your life. And Elohim remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the cattle that were with him in the ark. And Elohim made a wind to pass over the earth, and the water subsided. Now it says in verse 1, the water subsided. We think, well, that was the end of it. That means it never quit coming up. The up stopped in that verse. And then he's going to explain to us how it all began to dissipate later on. But remember, in this particular chapter, what we're dealing with is the word remember is very important. I'll give it to you in just a little bit. I'll give you some information on that word. But let me read a couple more verses. And the fountains of the deep and the windows of heaven were stopped. So this water came from different places. It wasn't just rain. Rain didn't put this type of water, this deluge we're talking about. We have the fountains of the deep and the windows of heaven were producing rain. They were stopped. And the rain from heaven was withheld. So we have three different methods that we're looking at. We have the fountains of the deep burst forth. So this huge caverns of water reservoirs that was in the earth, they burst forth and the water was coming from underneath. It was, and the windows of heaven were open. How do we know we have waters above the firmament? Because he told us that in Bereshit 1. We looked at that. He separated waters from the waters. Yeah. Meaning there's waters above and there's waters beneath. He separated the waters from the waters. And then he separated the earth from the waters. So we see all that God designed. So that water that was above, he opened the windows of heaven. It began to pour down. And then what happened? The clouds begin to move around and the moisture begin to be released from the clouds. So we have rain, we have water from the windows of heaven, and we have water from the fountain of the deep, all coming at the same time. And it's coming in a mighty torrent. It's not something that's trickling in. It's coming with viciousness. And that's why they're going to need to be in an ark. And when we looked at the size of the ark, going to the ark encounter, you kind of get an idea of why you need such a boat. Why it has to be built so massive and so strong. And why does it have to have pitch inside and outside? All of this comes into play, and you start to get an idea of that God has to, and it's just to save 8 people. But when God brings salvation, he brings the best he can bring. And so we have an ark. His name's Yeshua. We have to get in that ark. When God says get in, you get in. And you don't start having some debate with God or some conversation. Well, Lord, I just want to talk to you. I'm trying to explain to you why. Well, you don't have to explain anything about why you sinned. The fact is you sin. We have sinned. We have to repent from our sin and then lock eyes with him and stay in the ark. That's what we have to do. The issue is not trying to get people in the ark. It's trying to keep people in the ark. That's the job of the church. The church, you know how many people I've seen said they want to get in the ark since I started doing this? You know how many people that is? This building can't hold them. Said, I want to be in the ark, but you can't keep them in the ark. You can't keep them because once they get in the ark, they feel that confident. They feel like, I got this. I got this. And then they start looking. The moment they start looking, before you know it, they're going. Because you're going to be drawn away by the lust of the eye, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life. You're going to be taken away from it. And that's exactly what happened to all the people that wouldn't listen. For 120 years, while the ark was preparing, Noah was preaching, it's coming, the deluge is coming, it's coming, it's coming. You got to stay in the ark. You got to get over here. You got to come give us a hand. Nobody was helping. Nobody was giving a hand. For 120 years, nobody was listening. And when the deluge came and Noah was commanded to go in the ark and Jehovah shut the door, there was nobody coming in after that. And the fountains of the deep burst forth, the windows of heaven were open, and the rain began to rain, and there was nothing like anybody had ever seen. This had not happened in the earth up to this time. Nothing like this has ever happened. And there was no escape from it. They would crawl to the highest mountains and they said, we're going to get away from it. If you had money, in those days, you was able to pay your way to get, we're going to escape this. We're going to get to the highest peak, and we're going to survive this. Well, they went and they figured out, they got to the top, and the water came 15 cubits above the highest top. And then all of a sudden, the only thing stopped it was, and the fountains of the deep and the windows of heaven were stopped, and the rain from heaven was withheld, and the waters receded steadily from the earth. At the end of the 150 days, the waters diminished. I'd like you to look at Malachi chapter 3. I'm going to point that out because this really helps us kind of set the tone for chapter 8. I put it in your slide presentation. In the third chapter of Malachi, it says, "Then those who fear Yehovah speak to one another, and Yehovah listen and hear, and a book of remembrance be written before him of those who fear Yehovah and those who think upon his name. And they shall be mine, says Yehovah of hosts, on the day that I prepared a treasured possession. I shall spare them as a man spares his own son who serves him. Then you shall again see the difference between the righteous and the wrong, between the one who serves Elohim and the one who does not serve him." And so what he is showing here in this time of Noah, God, you've seen the ones who served Elohim and the ones who did not serve Elohim. The ones who served Elohim, when you serve, you can't say, "I serve him," and you don't obey his commands. Because there's no truth in that. Because when he says, "I command you to get in the ark," you don't get in the ark. The same is going to happen to you that happens to those who commit the wrong. We know the wrong is not listening to him. For 120 years, he's saying, "Get in the ark, get in the ark." Nobody's listening. Nobody's paying attention. As a matter of fact, they're laughing at Noah and saying, "You're so ridiculous. Ain't nobody listening to you no more. Nobody's paying attention to what you're saying." And he's constantly saying, "Get in the ark, get in the ark." And it's just a few of you. Look, all of us, we know better. We know what's happening. And we're the biggest group. We're going to stay doing what we're doing. Okay, you do that. And Malachi says, he'll remember those, and a book is written, and he'll make sure that we understand that he has prepared a day, that he's prepared a treasured possession. And this is what he calls those who listen to him, the treasured possession. "And I shall spare them as a man spares his own son who serves him. Then you shall see again the difference between the righteous and the wrong." How many know there's a difference between the righteous and the wrong? And who declares that difference? We don't get to declare that. He does. He declares the difference between the righteous and the wrong. Where was the righteous at? They were in the ark. Why? Because they listened to God. They got ears to hear what he says. You had ears to hear what the Spirit says to the church. Those who have ears to hear, they're going to be in the right place at the right time doing the right thing. Those who don't have ears to hear, they're going to be doing their thing, whatever they want to do. They're going to be living a compromised life. And when you live a compromised life, the consequences are going to be the same as the wrong. You can't sort of hang out with God. You can't sort of ride the fence. You can't live a compromised life. And this is what he said. You're going to see the difference between the righteous and the wrong, between the one who serves Elohim and the one who does not serve him. So what happened to the ones who served Elohim in Noah's case? What happened? The ones who served Elohim in Noah's case, they was kept. They were in the ark and they were kept alive. No matter how heavy the deluge came, it didn't matter if the fountain was bursting from the deep or the windows of heaven were open or the rain descended upon the earth. It didn't matter. They were protected. But those who did not live for Yehovah during that time, what happened to them? They all died. Not one of them survived. They could not survive because there was nothing that could keep them. There was no ark for them to be in. They couldn't make their own ark. They couldn't say, well, and that, listen, no doubt there were people who tried to make flotation devices. Because it's water coming. Let's grab a big log. Let's just get on a big log and we'll hold on to the log. Well, then when the fountains of the deep burst forth and the windows of heaven open and them two things meet, what happens when you have two different currents in the seas? What happens? What happens when you're going out of Salt Pass, and the tide's falling real hard, and you got the river going and the tide going the same way, and the wind's blowing from offshore coming in. What happens when you're going out of Salt Pass? What happens to the waves? They mount up, and it gets contrary. And I'm telling you, it gets a little nerve-wracking when you're going out. You got to really watch yourself. And I mean, you'll go up, because, but when the conditions are right, you can go out the same pass, and it's beautiful. But when those conditions are opposing each other, and we have opposing things happening, and this is what happens. When things are, there's no way you can escape that. Holding on to a log is not the answer. And many of them, no doubt, was holding on with all their might. They couldn't do it because of the severity of what came. And he kept telling them for 120 years, it's coming, it's coming. And you know, in all culture settings, every cultural group talks about this deluge in their history. Now, we hardly learn about that because this is not history taught in school, but you can look at all the ancients, the ancient Greeks, the Egyptians, all of them speak of, the Mayans, all of them speak of a deluge that happened in the history of time where all man was wiped out, and they talk about this big boat. In China, the stories are there for you to go look at it in China. In Japan, the stories are there. All ancient histories talk about this deluge. And the Bible talks about it, and somehow, you know, we don't want to take God at his word because it's the Bible. But he speaks of this deluge way in advance before all these ancient cultures, because all these people, they were all gone. And now we have a fresh start. We have Noah and his three sons and their wives, and all descendants today come from this group. So your descendants come from this group of Noah and his three sons and their wives. All descendants come from this group of people. So you think maybe we ought to look at it a little bit? Noah had Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Three sons, and from them, and then you'll see that, I think I listed that in the 10th chapter. You'll see the list there, all the names. Every name is put, looked up and pronounced for our understanding and what it means. And so with that in mind, I want you to look at Isaiah 49, verse 16. It says, "See, I have inscribed you on the palm of my hand." I don't know if you, I thought about this. I don't know if you've read this. Sometimes one verse don't get a lot of attention. "I have inscribed you on the palm of my hand. Your walls are always before me." I want you to understand that. Take your hand, look at your hand. You don't have to take a pen because I don't want you to write on yourself. But some people are used to writing. They make a little note or inscribe on a hand. But if you would like to, you can inscribe your name on the palm of your hand right now. Or you can do it with you can do it with your finger. And I want you to understand that's what Jehovah said he did. He inscribed you, every one of you, on the palm of his hand. Why is that? So when you do write a note on your hand, what do? If you're in school, the only people in school is in this section right here. Sometimes is a reminder. Right? You ever done that?
No.
Never done that?
No, we got technology now. It's all up here.
All up there? No. who's ever wrote a note on their hand to look at? And so so let me tell you, when after I had been out of school a long time, I was in captain school. Uh-huh. And in captain school, some of the guys, the grown guys, grown men, taking the test, they was writing the notes on their hand. And we go in the next, they tell you, you go in the room, the next 20 minutes, you're in the test room. Well, nobody knew this. We get in the test room, Coast Guard walks in. Oh. And he says, "Okay. So everybody understands this, If you wrote on your hand, they handed Windex out and paper towels and said, spray your hand so I don't throw you out the class. I'm glad I didn't write on my hand. I didn't have the Windex, but there were guys in there. It was so funny. But you know, they knew something. You inscribe on your hand to remember something. That's what you do. Look what Yehovah says. He says, you, he has inscribed you on his hand. For what? To remember you. So guess what? At this particular case, he had Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and their wives, and Noah's wife on the palm of his hand, and he remembered them. It's a reminder. It's to try to get you to remember. And so I thought about how he writes you and I on the palm of his hand. He's not forgotten you. He's remembering you. He remembers everything about you. And sometimes we feel like we're forgotten. We feel like we don't have any hope left. But he remembers you. He wants to remember you. Why would he say in Isaiah, see, I have inscribed you on the palm of my hand? Why would he say that if it's not for him to remember you? Your walls are always before me. He wants us to understand that he's very much involved in our well-being. He's very much involved in where you spend eternity. He's involved. And his desire is that we all spend eternity with him, not apart from him. He don't want us apart from him because he wants us in his presence. And so we see the wonderful and magnificent way God does things. In Jeremiah 17:13, it says, O Yehovah, the expectation of Israel, all who forsake you are put to shame. Those who depart from me shall be written in the earth. So you're going to be written somewhere, either in the palm of his hand or you're going to be written in the earth. So the ones in the ark was written where? In the palm of his hand. And the ones that was in the earth, where were they written? They were written in the earth. There was no escape from it. Their death, everything, their demise was written in the earth, and they were taken by the earth. There was no getting around it. Nothing could stop it. That's why we have these great sediments and deposits from all this torrential stuff that was happening, these torrents from the deep and from the, and there was, everything was being buried in sediments and new landscape was being created. That's how we had all the animals that got compacted and all this soil. It's where we have the oil that we find today. Where do you think all this came from? It came from this great deluge in which God, so in the process of God getting rid of all that was opposed him or against him, he still took all that he did and he used it as a preservation for life later on. It's absolutely amazing when you look at it in the whole scope of things, how God used something so disastrous to actually preserve life later on. And we have these used all deposits that we find that comes from that organic stuff breaking down over periods of time and compressed. And we have what's called crude oil. We find it all over. And the fact that it's in there and it incubates and it produces gas. It's where we get our natural gas from. It makes pockets. And so all the fountains of the deep burst forth and it left these big caverns of emptiness. Then all of that fell in to these caverns to the deep and they were inscribed in the earth because they were against Yehovah. Jeremiah says, O Yehovah, the expectations of Israel, all who forsake you are put to shame. Those who depart from me shall be written in the earth because they have forsaken Yehovah, the fountains of living waters. They've forsaken the fountains of living waters. In Psalms 111, verse 5, he has given food to those who fear him. He remembers his covenant for how long? Forever. He remembers his covenant forever. So he remembered the covenant he has with Noah because he told him, I command you to get in the ark. Now he's in the ark. And what did the verse open up? And Yehovah remembered Noah. He remembered him. Very important that we understand what God does when the word remember is zakar. It's 2142, which means to remember, to be mindful, or bring to remembrance. And from which we get the word zikron, meaning memorial or commemoration or remembrance. And so how many thank God that he remembered you? He could have left you. He could have left you in the mire. He could have left you in the mistake. He could have left you in your fault and failure. But instead, he had the gospel preached, and you heard the gospel, and it's something rung true in your heart. And you then you repented from your sin, and you come to him, and you locked eyes with him. Do we have to continue locking eyes with him? Absolutely. It's not a one-time event, and then you go on and live the way you want to live. You don't get in the ark and then kind of, well, I tell you what, I'm going to go hang out on the deck. You don't go hang out on the deck. You stay in the ark. You're not off the boat, but you're on top of the boat. You're going to hang out on the deck. I'm going to go sunbathe. I'm going to lay out a little bit. The moment you relax, the moment you take your eyes off of being locked in with him is the minute the enemy comes and he's before you know it, you're overcome by the deluge. There's no getting out of it. We see that happen time and time and time again. Over and over and over, we see this process happening. I'm going to read something to you. Go to 1 Peter. First Peter chapter 2, verse 1. But there also came to be false prophets among the people, as also among you there shall be false teachers, who shall secretly bring in destructive heresies and deny the master who brought them, bring in swift destruction on themselves. And many shall follow their destructive ways, because of whom the way of truth shall be evil spoken of. Do you know that the way of truth is being evil spoken of even today in our society? The way of truth is evil spoken of. You don't have to deal, you don't have to learn anything about the ark. You don't have to learn anything about Noah. Why would you have to go back and study the Torah? That don't make sense. We have the renewed writings. The way of truth is evil spoken of. Constantly happens. And in greed and fabricated words, they shall use you for gain. From of old, their judgment does not linger, and their destruction does not slumber. For if Elohim did not spare the messengers who sinned, but sent them to Tartarus to deliver them into chains of darkness to be kept for judgment, and did not spare the world of old, but preserved Noah, a proclaimer of righteousness, and seven others, bringing in the floods on the world of the wicked, and having reduced to ashes the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, condemning them to destruction, having made them an example to those who afterward would live wickedly, and rescued righteous Lot, who was oppressed with the indecent behaviors of the lawless. For day after day, the righteous man dwelling among them tortured his righteous being by seeing and hearing these lawless works. What is the opposition of Lot in this situation? Lawlessness versus righteousness. Lawlessness versus righteousness. In Noah's situation, why is Noah in the ark and the rest is left out of the ark? Because they love lawlessness more than they love righteousness. Righteousness is what's found in the ark. And so what we see happening here is that the same thing, these opposing factors happen constantly, even in Lot's situation. And then Jehovah knows how to rescue the reverent ones from trial, and to keep his unrighteous, keep the unrighteous until the day of judgment to be punished. And most of all, those walking after the flesh in filthy lust and despising authority, bold, headstrong, speaking evil of esteemed ones. Is that not happening today? This is all happening today. And so I'm showing you, the reason I'm reading in 2 Peter, I'm just trying to show you this, what's happening today is connected to the flood of Noah. It's connected. And so when we read this, when we read Noah's story, brings to our attention is this 2 Peter account. And he's telling us, this is the stuff you're going to see happening today. And I'm just asking you, are you seeing this actually happen today? Are you witnessing with your own eyes the prophetic picture that's painted for us? Thousands of years ago it's prophetically painted, yet it's actually manifesting itself today. Is it not? So do you think maybe we just need to wake up a little bit and realize that we have to love the truth? We have to get in the ark. We have to lock eyes with Yeshua and make sure we stay in him. Because if not, we'll succumb to the same tragic event that happened during this time that he's pointing out to us. And he's showing us clearly, not, this is no ambiguity here. He clearly shows us that the prophetic picture that we're going to witness today is actually manifesting itself just based upon us understanding this life of Noah and what happened. If God could have fixed it another way, he would have. The same thing today. If he could fix it another way, he would. But he can't fix it a different way. He already sent the ark for us, and he says, get in. Get in the ark. And there are many people today who are not listening to him. Because they refuse to even look at Noah's story anymore. They refuse to look at it. They don't mind you teaching it to the kids as a little storybook form. But we don't want to get in the meat of it, because we get in the meat of it, now we're following the Torah. We don't ever want to do that, because we follow the Messiah. Well, then he uses his apostles to come along and say, hey, in case you forgot, go read the story of Noah. And he's telling us this as a fact in the second chapter of Peter 1 here. He's telling us as a fact. And he tells us that this is happening. He said, and most of all, those walking after the flesh in filthy lust, despising authority, bold, headstrong, speaking evil of esteemed ones, whereas messengers who are greater in strength and power did not bring a slanderous accusation against them before the master. Not even the messengers. The messengers understand that when God calls somebody for a job, listen, if God could have called somebody else, he'd have called somebody else, but he called Noah. Because Noah was the only one who was listening to God. And if he wouldn't have called Noah, who's the only one listening, there would have been no ark, there'd have been no way of protection, and it'd have been finished. All would have been lost. But instead of all being lost, God preserved a remnant, just a few. And it's the same thing in the end days. He says, if it wouldn't be for God to shorten the days, all's going to be lost, but he's going to preserve a remnant. He's going to come back for a few. But we can't despise the one God calls. You can't do that. He's telling us, why would you do that? The messengers wouldn't even give the translation in King James said they didn't give a railing accusation against those, because they understood authority. They understood how God sets up stuff. They understood how this thing was seated long ago, before we ever thought about it. God had put everything in place that's happening today. Before we ever thought about it, God had worked out every detail. He orchestrated it, masterfully planned it out. So we have to be careful when we speak against authority. And they were speaking against Noah. But in the end, what happened? Noah turned out to be right. I hate for people to find out in the end that it turns out that what we're saying is right. Because by the time you find that out, it'll be too late. There'll be no time to run to it and say, oh, I'm sorry, I'm so sorry. Let me in, let me in. You can paw and scratch all you want. There's no getting in, because when God shuts the door, nobody gets in after that. I'm sure there were many of them who changed their mind when the fountains of the deep broke loose. All of a sudden, you're walking around in your field and a big hole blows open and it's just shooting water from the ground. But in large volumes, within seconds, it's over your head. You climb the first tree you get to, and you keep climbing, and it just gets higher and higher. You know you done messed up. You know you got some real problems. And then you try to survive that And before you know it, something breaks loose and comes floating by. So you leave the tree. You get on that. You say, okay, I got it. I feel better. And then all of a sudden, the windows of heaven open up and go right on you and wash you off the log. Now you're in trouble again, and you're scrambling. And then you're trying to find your way, constantly trying to find your way, trying to make it happen for my, I'm trying to make it happen. I'm just trying to get it all together. You know, that's the excuses everybody uses. You know, when it all gets right, I'm going to come to God, I'm going to serve God. But right now, I'm trying to get my life together. Always going from a tree to a log, and you're never going to be successful because there's always, the deluge is going to overpower you. There's no hope for that. Finally, you get to a mountain, you start climbing. You're climbing as fast as you go, and it's coming up behind you. You get to the top of the mountain, and you say, okay, I'm safe. I can't go. You can't go no higher. You done got to the top. You were successful. You made the success you're going to make in life. You can't go no higher. You're at the top. And all of a sudden, the deluge comes and takes all of those at the top. It don't matter how much money you got. It don't matter how rich you are. It don't matter how famous you are. It don't matter who's your daddy, who's your mama. It doesn't matter what side of the track you grew up on. The deluge is coming, and it's going to take everybody who's not in the ark. And here's Lot's situation. He's in Sodom and Gomorrah. And who's praying for him? Avram. Saying, God, if there's 50 righteous, will you spare them? He said, if you find 50, I'll spare them. God's not out to kill. He's not out to destroy. He said, find me 50 righteous. Those who will listen to, what he means when he says 50 righteous? Those who are listening to me, because you can't obtain righteousness without listening. It's not something you can obtain. You can't do it from yourself because we have a sin nature that's been passed on to us. Noah had a sin nature. I want you to understand that. Noah was not absent from the sin nature. He was passed on that sin nature from his ancestor Adam. But what happened to Noah was he didn't let his sin nature override his ability to hear from God. And God said, get in the ark. Noah's got in the ark. But he couldn't get in something he didn't participate in building. He first told him to build an ark. Prepare your way out. I want you to start preparing. And he had to work hard, had to prepare. It took him a long time, 120 years he prepared the ark. 120 years, a long time. Many of us will never see 120 years. That's how long it took him to build an ark. And the whole time he was preaching, saying, the deluge is coming, it's coming, it's coming. Not to mention that Methuselah was preaching the same thing, echoing the same message. And he died 7 days leading up to the flood coming. And when he died, there was nothing to stop it from happening to manifest itself. Because he would still, as long as he was alive, it would not manifest itself. And then God showed that this process was going to happen based upon prophetically what was spoken, that it was coming and nothing could stop it. Noah prophesied as hard as he could. And so what we see here in Lot's case, Noah got down to 10. He said, oh, if there's 10 righteous, just once more. You know, he was going down this list, narrowing the number. Once more, if there's 10, and what did God say? If you find 10, I can do it for 10. I'll spare them. I won't destroy them. But he couldn't find 10 in two cities. In two cities, there weren't 10 people who would live for God and do what was right. And so God had no choice but to destroy those cities. But notice what it says about Lot, that he was going through it, the righteousness that he walked in was being hurt every day. I'll read it to you again. Day after day, that righteous man dwelling among them tortured his righteous being by seeing and hearing their lawless works. Seeing and hearing. Then Jehovah knows how to rescue the reverent ones from trials and to keep the unrighteous until the day of judgment to be punished. And most of all, those walking after the flesh in filthy lust and despising authority, bold, headstrong, speaking evil of esteemed ones, whereas messengers who are greater in strength and power do not bring a slanderous accusation against them before the master. But these, like natural, unreasoning beasts, having been born to be caught and destroyed, blaspheme that which they do not know, shall be destroyed in their destruction. What's going to happen? They're going to be destroyed. As much as you don't want that to, that to happen, is exactly what's going to happen. They'll be destroyed in their destruction. Being about to receive the wages of unrighteousness, deeming indulgence in the day of pleasure, spots and blemishes, reveling in their own deception while they feast with you. Having eyes filled with adulterous and unable to cease from sin, enticing unstable beings, having a heart trained in greed, children of a curse. Having left the right way, they went astray, having followed the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness. But he was rebuked for his transgression, a dumb donkey speaking with the voice of a man restrained the madness of the prophet. These are fountains without water, clouds driven by a storm, of whom the blackness and darkness is kept forever. For speaking arrogant nonsense, they entice you through the lust of the flesh, through indecency. And one who has indeed escaped from those living in delusion, promising them freedom, though themselves being slaves of corruption, for one is a slave of whatever overcomes him. He's a slave of whatever overcomes him. And in the case of someone who's constantly arrogant and bold and speaking of esteemed one, when he does that, whatever, he's overcome by that, he becomes that. And so is that not what we prophetically are seeing happening today? So we have to stay in the ark. For if after they have escaped the defilement of the world through the knowledge of the Master and Savior Yeshua Messiah, they are again entangled in them and overcome, the latter end is worse for them than the first. For if it would have been better for them not to have known the way of righteousness than having known it, to turn from the set-apart commands delivered unto them. Set-apart commands. What is the set-apart commands that was delivered to them? Think about that. For them the proverb has proven true. A dog returns to his own vomit, and a washed soul returns to her rolling in the mud. Because that's by nature what they want to do. You know, you can take a pig and you can wash it clean. You can put a white dress on it and put red lipstick on it. And you can turn it loose and it's going to go right back in the swallow that it came from. It's not going to do something different because by nature it's a swine, it's a pig. And so the only hope we got is our nature has to be changed. If not, if our nature's not changed, we're going to go back to the same thing too. It's not going to be any different. We're going to do the same exact thing. The same thing that we fled from that was destructive, that caused us to come to God and say we want to accept Yeshua, is the very same thing we're going to go back to if we don't get in Him. Now, meeting Him is one thing. Walking outside the ark saying, there's the ark. I love the ark. I want to be in the ark. I just want to devote my life to the ark. That's one thing. You can walk around it as many times as you want. You can praise it. You can worship it. You can do all those things. But you ain't done nothing until you get in it. And the door shut. When you get locked in with Him, there's a big difference between giving praise to the ark. And I'm convinced a lot of people's giving a lot of praise to Yeshua, but they're not in Yeshua. And what makes the difference of being in Yeshua is you do what He said. You don't back talk Him. You don't try to make up some explanation on why you don't have to do it. You do what He said. And I can show you in this Torah portion, it's going to show us how many times people don't do what He says. For there are fountains without water driven by a storm, to whom the blackness and darkness is kept forever. For speaking arrogant nonsense, they entice through the lust of the flesh, through indecencies, the one having indeed escaped from those living in delusion, promising them freedom, though themselves be enslaved of corruption, for one is a slave to whatever overcomes him. And if after they have escaped the defilement of the world through the knowledge of the Master and Savior Yeshua Messiah, and they are again entangled in them, overcome the latter end worse. The latter end is worse for them than the first. It would have been better for them not to have known the way of righteousness than having known it and turned from it and turned from the set apart commands delivered unto them. For then the Proverbs has been proven true: a dog returns to his own vomit, and a washed soul returns to the rolling in the mud. And it's so important that we grab hold to that principle. Now go back to our text, main text, in Genesis 8. Let's see if we can just go a little bit further in this. And Elohim remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the cattle that were with him in the ark. And Elohim made a wind pass over the ark, the earth, and the water subsided. He made a wind pass over the earth. Again, that wind that he made pass over the earth, again, is connected to the Ruach, the same spirit of Yehovah that hovered over the face of the waters. Again, that wind passes over the earth, and the water subsides. And the fountains of the deep and the windows of heaven were stopped, and the rain from the heavens were withheld, and the waters receded steadily from the earth. And at the end of the 150 days, the waters were diminished. And in the seventh new moon, the seventh day of the new moon, dark rested on the mountains of Ararat. Not Mount Ararat, but mountains, meaning the mountains of Ararat is a large range. Large range. It's in modern day Turkey. A large range of mountains. So which one? We don't know. Now we have the discovery of Ryan Wyatt. So now we have a better example that's given to us to go back and look at and study it out for ourselves. But the ark, which should be, how many know that the ark being found should be big news in the world? Yet, very few people knew about it. Very few people was made aware of it. Very few people even showed any interest in it. Because we so far past Noah. Who wants to go back to Noah? What does Noah have to do with what Yeshua is doing for me right now? He has everything to do with what Yeshua is doing for you right now. Because unless we understand the story of Noah, we don't even understand that we have a Yeshua coming who's going to be our ark. We have no concept of that. Notice that in the seventh new moon, the 17th day of the new moon, the ark rested on the mountains of Ararat. We're given a time stamp. When did this happen? In the seventh month. What's significant about the seventh month? What's significant about the seventh month? On the first of the seventh, what happens? What starts to happen in the first of the seventh month? What starts to happen? What's the first thing you hear? That's Yom what? Teruah. So now you got where I'm going? We have a time stamp. It rested on the mountains of Ararat in the seventh month. So we have the sounding of the trumpet. We have the time of Yom Kippur. We have the time of Sukkot. It's all happening. It's in that same month that this ark rested. And the waters decreased steadily until the 10th new moon. Now the reason I want you to understand that it says the water subsided was not that the waters dried up at that particular time, but they subsided, meaning it quit rising. But now we still have all this water and we got to do something with it. Where is it going to go? What's going to happen to this water? And so he's telling us the length of time, so if it rests on the mountain of Ararat, the water had to come down some. Why? Because the water had exceeded the highest mountains by 15 cubits. So it came down quite a bit for the ark to rest on the top of the mountain. Came down quite a bit. And then it goes on and says, And the waters decreased steadily until the 10th new moon. How many see that? We have 7, 8, 9, 10. So the waters increasing steady until the 10th new moon. And in the 10th new moon, on the first day of the new moon, the tops of the mountains became visible, meaning more that you can actually see now. So the highest one, the ark's resting on, and now the rest of them that was lower, now you begin to see them, and he gives all these timestamps. How many see these timestamps? Is this important, these timestamps? Valuable. Valuable, these timestamps. In the 10th new moon, on the first day of the new moon, the tops of the mountains became visible. And it came to be at the end of 40 days that Noah opened the windows of the ark which he had made. So we'll stop just right there for a minute. I want to talk about some of this just for a little bit. You'll see in your slide presentation, I put some stuff in there concerning the 10th month and the tops of the mountains becoming visible. Has anybody read that stuff? Who hadn't read it? You didn't get it down to reading it yet. Okay, there's a lot going on there, and I want to point out this stuff because it's valuable for our understanding. Verse 4, we see that on the 17th day of the 7th month, the ark came to rest on the mountains of Ararat. In the Hebrew, the word Ararat, if you look up that word Ararat, it means the curse reverse or the reversal of the curse. That's 8780. Now, it rested on the where the curse is reversed. So, we have a curse that can get reversed, and it's going to, and we've shown the first part of this reverse of the curse in the story of Noah. When the ark rests on the mountain of Ararat, it means the reverse of the curse. Is that important? Well, if you're dealing with a curse, you need it reversed. It's very important. Well, how many know we're all dealing with a curse? It's called the curse of death. And we need that curse reversed, and we got to find out who's the one who's going to do that for us. Who's going to reverse that curse? Do we need it reversed? You better believe it. Just because Noah's in the ark and he's now saved, he still has to face death. Noah's got to face death. Why? Because the sin nature of Adam's still on him, and it's on his sons, and it's on their wives. Still there. So now we have to see, how is God going to fix this? He already saved them from this deluge. He saved them from the deluge. But how does he fix this? And we're going to see this wonderful picture of how this curse, which is death, is taken away. The ark comes to rest on this mountain. Is a powerful picture of the great provision of Elohim for all who have responded to his call to come out of darkness and find rest in Messiah, our King. Though the ark had come to rest, the waters were still receding, and it was only on the first of the 10th month that the tops of the mountains became visible. Everybody say the first of the 10th month. They became visible, meaning you could see it with your eyes. So what else does he want us to see with our eyes? The mountains become visible on the first of the 10th month. I find a very powerful prophetic promise being given here, especially as we consider the ark coming to rest on the mountain that means the curse reversed. As one takes a closer look at the timing of the birth of Yohanan the Immerser, we're able to clearly acknowledge the birth of Messiah being on the first day of Sukkot. And then it takes you through this, these accountings of scriptural evidence that show this and how important. Now, where do we learn this? We learn this in the second Torah portion. We learn this. So we don't get shocked when Matthew writes. We're not shocked when Matthew writes his account. And when Matthew writes his account, you know, we're reading the account of Matthew, we see the genealogists or the genesis of Yeshua, and we read the story of Mary, the gives birth to Messiah. And we don't read that story, and all of a sudden, at the end of that story, the Joseph is the husband, who their spouse, and it's not his child. And so we have this baby born in Bethlehem, wrapped in swaddling clothes, lying in the manger. We don't read that story, and all of a sudden, out of the blue, we come up with December the 25th. Yet millions of believers, those who claim to be in the ark, have come up with that suggestion. So much so, it's what you do. It's a proven fact. It's proven. Until somebody slows down just a little bit, goes back and look at Noah, and we understand from the life of Noah's story, he tells us when it's going to be. He gives time stamps. We don't get to suggest a time. We don't get to say, well, I believe it's this. And it becomes truth after you say something. If you say a lie long enough and loud enough, people will say it's the truth. That's what Hitler used as part of his way to start dominating the world. He just told a lie long enough and loud enough until people believe it, and he didn't quit until 6 million Jews were dead. 6 million. When's the last time you ever heard of something at the caliber of 6 million people dying? Not in our lifetime. We hear of somebody getting killed here, somebody getting killed there, maybe a few people going down here, a few people going down there. And then you have, you might have a shooting like just recently happened, and 17, 18 people die in one day. And that, I mean, we're frantic about the whole thing. Yet the whole world had to actually be pressured into going into war during Hitler's time. He was killing them millions at a time. And it's like it was no alarm. Because he told it long enough and loud enough, people thought it was true. First thing he did, he disarmed the people. He told them, you didn't need protection from the government. The government's going to protect you. He told it over and over and over and over again till people believed it. And they just gave their weapons up freely. And after they gave them up, they showed up the next day at their door and took them by force. Nobody had anything to defend themselves. The ones that you had, a few loners, a few guys that who hid their stuff. They quickly grabbed their weapons, but they were so outnumbered, they got rid of them quick. So outnumbered. They were dealing with a massive army, an army that none the world didn't even know Hitler had managed to get such an army. And they were armies of brutality. Bloodthirst was in their eyes. The only thing that satisfied them was blood. And they killed at liberty as many as they possibly could. Until different people started joining the war. America came into war under a trick. We're bringing in supplies, and what they had to do to convince America to get into the war is blow up the supply ships thinking the enemy did it. And what it was is the good guys blew it up to make them trick. I mean, thinking the enemy did it, and so then we went all. Once we got in full stream, the war ended quick, because we came in with such force, it was overwhelming. They couldn't handle the amount. We brought in so many bodies in D-Day. We dropped off so many soldiers who had the guts to run into the fire, and even though it was not their fight, they were fighting for humanity. And people died by the thousands. Young military, 17, 18-year-old military boys died by the thousands on D-Day because they believed in something. They believed in humanity. They believed in life. But this is what happens when you have somebody who tells a lie long enough and loud enough, people start believing the nonsense. And you got to know what's the difference between a lie and a truth. If not, you'll believe a lie. And so if you don't know what the truth is, you don't know what to believe. That's why it's important that we get down to the rock of it and get to the truth of what he's saying here, so you're not succumbed by the lie. You don't listen to the lie. And that's what happens constantly. When it's a lie, it'll always be a lie. And you need to know the difference. From this account, we're able to see the clear prophecy of Messiah, the rock of our deliverance, coming forth as promised seed to take away the curse of which is death, in order to renew his covenant and give us life in him. This account is a prophetic shadow picture of the conception of Messiah as announced in the promised prophetic word contained in Yeshayahu. In Yeshayahu it says, therefore, Jehovah himself gives you a sign. Look, the Alma conceives and gives birth to a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. The Alma there is the virgin. She's the Alma. Meaning, in that the Alma there, what we have is the Mem. The Mem is closed at the beginning of a word, which is not what happens in Hebrew. The Mem is never closed at the beginning of a word. It closes at the end of a word. Yet we have the Mem closed at the beginning of the word, showing that her womb was closed. It never been opened up by any human penetration. She was a virgin. And so we see God, again, through his word, showing the protection and how he preserved the virgin birth for the Spirit of Jehovah to move upon her and impregnate her. And so from what was inside of her coming out would then open up the Mem and be delivered to the world as Emmanuel. How beautiful is that? But we see that picture. It's painted for us so beautifully. He in this prophecy on the conception of the birth of Messiah were able to link up the picture of the top of Mount Ararat becoming visible with the conception of Miriam and the timing of this being very clear and fitting with scriptural patterns which announce the good news, which is Yeshua Messiah. This prophecy speaks of the conception of the Alma and the birthing of the Son, who shall be called Emmanuel, highlighting for us the clear timing of the conception to birth, which we know is a 40-week period. It's a 40-week period. And so we're going to see something. Now, the first visible sign of the mountain was when? On the first of the 10th month. So we know that timing, a time stamp is given to us. Keep that in mind because that's important. The Hebrew word Alma is Strong's 5959, means young woman, virgin, or maiden, and speaks of a young woman who had not yet known a man, i.e. still a virgin. And the Hebrew word that is translated as conceived is hara, which is Strong's 2029, which is a primitive root verb that means to conceive or become pregnant. For most of us, this is a clear prophecy that we do not know, and I am simply highlighting the Hebrew root word that confirms this fact. In a further prophecy of the Son who would be born unto us, we see something unique in the scriptural text, highlighting the clear expected promise of the Alma who would bring forth the promised Son. This is seen in Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6 and 7. For a child is born unto us, a son is given unto us, and the rule is on his shoulder. The wonderful counselor, the mighty God, eternal Father, called his name Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his rule and peace, there is no end upon the throne of David and over his reign to establish it and sustain it with right ruling and with righteousness from now on, even forever. The order of Jehovah of hosts does this. And so I put in there and I highlighted the interpretation of the wonderful counselor, mighty God, eternal Father, called his name Prince of Peace, and of the increase. You will notice the above, I have highlighted the phrase of the increase, and it is this phrase that bears the unique witness in the Hebrew text confirming the conception of the Alma or the Virgin. In the Hebrew text, these two verses, 5 and 6, in terms of the increase, is written in the Hebrew text as Le Merbir, Marbe, which comes from the root word Marbe, which is Strong 4766, which means abundant, increase, or great. And here it is speaking of the increase of the rule of the Shalom of Messiah as king. What you will notice as you look carefully at these words in Hebrew, that this verse contains something very peculiar, and this is the only place in Scripture that we see this occur. You will notice that the letter at the beginning of this word, Marbe, which is the Mem, is changed to being written in as a Mem, which is known as a closed Mem. So this closed Mem, grammatically, the closed Mem should only be used at the end of a word, not at the beginning or within a Hebrew word. This is understood as a clear mystery of the closed Mem, which carries great prophetic significance. By this fascinating mystery of the closed Mem being used at the beginning of a word and referring to the expected Messiah who would come to bring deliverance, shows us how he is the one who opens the womb, as this passage is dealing directly dealing directly, the child is born unto us. And we know that the Messiah was born of a maiden, one with a closed womb, a virgin. This miraculous birthing in the flesh of Messiah provides for us the perfect offering of our ransom, as Messiah not only being the firstborn from the dead, making us who are in him ransomed unto Elohim, but he also was the perfect slaughter that would be accepted to Yehovah in satisfying the requirements, as opening the womb, becoming the perfect lamb, ram, and bull offering for our deliverance and redemption. Okay, so what has this got to do with the first of the 10th month? A whole lot. Let me show you why I say this. As one takes a closer look at the timing of the birth of Yohanan the Immerser, we are able to clearly acknowledge the birth of Messiah being on the first day of Sukkot. In Luke chapter 1 gives us an account of when Yohanan was conceived, as we take note of his father, Zechariah, was serving as priest before Elohim in the order of his division. In Luke chapter 1, verse 5, there was in the days of Herod, the sovereign of Yehuda, a certain priest named Zechariah of the division of Aviah, and his wife was the daughter of Aaron. Her name was Elisheba. And from this account, in Luke 1, we're told that Zechariah was a priest of the division of Aviah. And in order to understand what this means, we are able to see that the division of Aviah was the 8th division according to 1 Chronicles 24:10, the 7th to Hakot, and the 8th to Aviah. The division of the priesthood were set up unto 24 divisions in the days of David and were clearly kept as such until the day of Messiah, as we see in Lucas, making it clear that Zechariah served in the order of his division in Luke 1:8. As soon as the days of his service were complete, Zechariah went home, and after those days, his wife Elisheba conceived in Luke chapter 1, verse 23 and 24. In order for us to establish the timing of the 8th division, we're able to recognize that after the exile of Yehuda, Ezra 6 records for us that the rebuilding of the house of Elohim was completed on the third day of the month of Adar, which is the 12th month, and then the priests were appointed according to their division. And so we'll stop right there, and we'll finish the rest of this reading, because I want to finish it out in the Midrash. Because I want you to see the significance of this timing of the birth of Messiah as a direct representation of our ark that we have to get in. We can't think about getting in. We have to get in. I want you to see the direct connection, not a sort of like, but a direct connection that's made by the timestamp given to us on the first of the 10th month. The mountains became visible, or what becomes visible in the spiritual realm. We have a duality happening there. We have physically what happened. Noah could see the tops of the mountain. Spiritually is when it's revealed that this Messiah would come, and now we can see it. So you can see Messiah's connection in the second Torah portion. And I want you to be able to see that in the scripture. So we'll finish that in the Midrash. Let's stand together.